It is Saturday, August 22nd, 2009, 10:06 on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and in the second half, the mom and pop of our local ISP mom and pop, Cruise.io, here in the room. And of course, they're actually the founders of Geek Speak, so 11 years now and counting.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Geek's Miles Elam. He's a slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Al Luckow. He's a new media architect. Hi, Al.
Hi.
You have a good USB of the Week device for us?
Crazy. Oh, yes, I do. Yes. Stick around for that.
The end of the show?
Yes.
And it will be amazing,
yes.
As it always is. And also in the air room, and Chris and Peggy, if you'd like to speak during the news segment, please do so. You guys are definitely geeks and can participate as much as you'd like. Okay?
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. I might as well introduce you guys now so everybody knows. Chris Nicholson is co-founder with Peggy Dulgenis. Did I do it?
Yeah, that was fantastic. I can't believe how smoothly you pulled that off. You know, we were kind of worried. We have those difficult names.
He's a professional, that's why.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. You know, that is.
And you guys actually started Geek Speak, if I'm not wrong about this, in March of 1998, I think March. I think that's what Wikipedia says, at least.
Yeah, totally. Your guess is as good as ours.
Yeah, and the station was very different then, and the show was a half an hour on Monday evenings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really easy to fill a half an hour. What do you have?
Just open up the calls.
You have an hour?
We have 7 hours today. So
oh, 7 hours?
Yep. Okay.
That's great. I've got some real great old stories sure everybody wants to hear. Hey, but you know, we're tweeting while we're in here now. It's
oh, good.
So
are
different.
You doing that right now?
Oh, absolutely. You can't see me, but I'm like tweeting totally.
All right, let's start with Geek News. Miles, you're up first, man.
A U.S. man has stolen 130 million credit card numbers through a variety of sites, including bank sites. Now, he was caught. He had a couple of accomplices. They believed that they were two unnamed Russian co-conspirators. And they were getting into payment systems of retailers, including like 7-Elevens and the like. Now, the thing that's alarming about it is the fact that he was using an SQL injection attack for all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the news has been reporting it as he got past the firewall, hacked past the firewall. Technically, that's true, but really it was more like someone set up a big wall to help to keep you from going in, and he just walked around it because they didn't finish the wall.
Or it's more like there was a hot dog stand inside the wall, and instead of going through the wall, somebody actually had taken hot dogs and put it outside the wall, and he just picked them up.
Basically,
the people inside messed up. So
right.
We're talking about it's a web application or some kind of application on the inside of the firewall, which actually has a bug in it so severe that you can take advantage of it.
No,
by telling
it wasn't
you what
the firewall.
Do.
Oh. It's within the web application.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that the web application... Oh. Was coded such that it could do things for you in the inside.
Right. So, I guess the point is that the firewall had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, nothing to do with it.
Just an SQL injection can cause that kind of thing.
And
but how common are those?
The thing is, though, that from a coding standpoint, those are extremely simple. This does not take ridiculous levels of computer skills. You don't need someone who knows the inner workings of the bits and bytes.
I guess I'm kind of confused to how an online application actually had real credit card numbers. Why isn't it just storing hashes of credit card numbers to then do comparisons?
There was the other thing.
Yeah.
One, SQL injection attack, which means it could execute arbitrary database queries.
It could access anything in the database.
And then the credit card numbers were kept in plain text in the database tables, which is another big no-no.
Right.
So I'm not just interested in the fact that this guy has to pay a fine, if convicted, of $250,000 for each of two charges and up to 5 years in jail.
Yeah, what about the people that provided this service to him?
Exactly. there's that issue of, wait a second, SQL injection attacks, I mean, they're a known quantity. They're not hard.
And in any web application development environment, it's easy to produce an application that has that bug. But it's also one function away to never have that problem. Like everything, everybody solved this on web applications.
Right.
And the PHP that, one is just a command, you know, your, MySQL and code. You know, it's not, no,
actually,
not difficult.
You shouldn't be using that either.
Oh, really?
You should be using parameterized functions, parameterized queries, which means that,
right,
you
that
your
sense.
Overall query, and then you have little placeholders.
Right.
Because
yeah, totally.
All of those designers, library designers, have made that thing that you're talking about already. It's done for everyone.
Right.
They just don't use it. Now, the part that really chaps my hide, though, is the fact that the maximum fine this guy could get is $500,000, mm-hmm. 500,000, mm-hmm. And 5 years in jail. A recent grad student was found guilty of file sharing 30 songs and is liable for something on the order of $9 million.
There's so you think our priorities are wrong?
Yeah, 30 songs, $9 million, 130 million credit card numbers and wire fraud, $500,000.
Music, hey, creativity is important.
I don't know what that guy wanted with all those hot dogs anyway. That's a lot of hot dogs.
Thanks, Miles, for that wonderful hot dog story. Al, hi. What's up with robots today?
Oh, robots. Well, we've got an interesting little thing. It's a swarm. It's called the Swarmoid Project. And it's...
It sounds bad already. Swarming robots is not a good thing.
Swarm. I don't really like... I can't really think of any swarms I really do like, actually. There's no swarms.
People?
A swarm of people. Okay.
Well, women, they're in a swarm. Do you really like them?
Yeah.
They're kind of better one-on-one.
It's
think
true.
Disney World.
Swarms aren't good in general.
I prefer a mob.
Yeah.
A mob to a swarm.
So is that a... Anyway, let's go on to the story.
Well, this was sent in...
Oh, wait. A robot mob does not sound good either.
Yeah, that's probably...
Did you ever see the movie Westworld?
Westworld, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what's happening every day now in robot land.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
It's all heading towards Skynet.
Yeah.
This was actually something that's sent in by a listener, Ryan Nestor.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah. This is about the Swarmite Project. It's from the Future and Emerging Technologies, or FET Open Project, funded by the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And the main scientific objective of this research project is the design, implementation, and control of a novel distributed robotic system. The system will be made up of heterogeneous, dynamically connected, small, autonomous robots. Collectively, these robots will form what is referred to as a swarmoid. The swarmoid that they intend to build will be comprised of numerous, about 60, autonomous robots of three types, iBots, HandBots, and FootBots. So this is like a whole bunch of these little things. This is actually based on a project that was a few years old called the Swarmoid Project, which was done in software. So they've simulated all these things in software.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now they're actually building the little robots to do all these things. It's being led by Dr. Marco Dorigo.
And the iBot, as an EYE, is a bot that has vision capability that can't move.
Right.
And then there's a leg bot that actually has ability to move around. And then there's a hand bot, which
they
can
call
actually,
it a foot bot.
Foot bot, excuse
yeah.
me. Right, so you've got these different bots that can do different things. One can grasp, but they can connect and
grow
and
be bigger. And they
want
to have 60 of them. So
does this thing kind of move around and like they all connect and
the
kind
of. The idea
is
to have them all like kind of thinking along the same lines, you know.
Do
hey, let's go over there. Everybody, ever go over there. And then they all go over there.
They kind of just roll. It's like a goo almost.
They all do. Some of them provide visual input and
see,
others.
That's not right. And how effectively can they remove flesh from a human being? Because that's what we need to see.
That'll be the next story.
Okay, go on.
And this from our listener, Ryan.
Yeah.
I, for one, welcome our heterogeneous, dynamically connected, small, autonomous, swarming robot overlords.
Thank you.
I tell you. Brian,
is there a mind bot?
I think they create
that
all of them
us.
Together is the mind bot. Are the mind is are the
where,
mind.
Where is the mind?
Be
all
the mind
direction
bot.
Comes from the meat puppet.
Maybe that's what it is. The meat puppets are still
well,
necessary.
Well, that's the robot.
That's what we like
we
to
have
think.
To keep ourselves in the loop.
Bags of water.
That's the crazy robot story I found this
bags
week.
Bags of mostly water. Yeah. Okay, thank you
ugly,
very much
ugly
for the
bags
bots.
Of mostly water.
Ugly bags of mostly water? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, come on. Angelina Jolie, come on.
Mostly ugly bags of mostly water.
Big lips.
All right. Thanks, Al, for the robot update. Miles, free speech?
Yes.
Gotta get political?
When do I not get political?
Go on.
So, in the past, we had Time Magazine had why Barack Obama could be the next president, a nice picture profile of him.
The four-color picture?
No. This was the original one was just him.
Okay.
And a student at a university, decided, I have nothing to do this winter break. I'm going to play around some Photoshop. And he turned Obama into the Joker on this Time Magazine image.
Okay.
And uploaded it to Flickr. And then some other folks took that image and took out the Time Magazine and just left Obama as the Joker and put in underneath the headline socialism.
Okay.
Well, all of that, I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't think that the Joker was a socialist for a variety of reasons.
Sociopath, maybe.
But at the same time, this is political speech.
Right.
This is absolutely.
Completely. Political figure modifies political figure.
Right. It's
a joke
satire.
About the satire of political.
Yes.
So therefore, something about the amendments that have to do with that.
Yeah, therefore it should fall under fair use with regard to copyright under all circumstances. Flickr, unfortunately, didn't agree. When this person had those images up on Flickr, Flickr got a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice.
From
someone.
Okay, right, because those aren't public.
And then took down the images.
With the argument that I'm assuming the photograph that was in Time was copyrighted, somebody else is using that copyrighted material.
That was the premise. At the same time, it's like, but this is pretty clearly fair use. I mean, not even ambiguously so.
Right.
Pretty clearly fair use.
You can't claim that to be anything but political satire, which is pretty clearly fair use.
Right. Now, yes. Flickr in general has been saying, we are just following the lawyer's advice and stuff like that.
Well, that's the thing is that the Millennium Digital Copyright Act takedown notice, you just follow them. Everybody just follows them.
Well,
and theoretically, you and I could just spam everything out there and people would just start taking stuff down.
Right. But in addition to that,
talk to an ISP.
Flickr also took down any comments and tags associated with that image, which they're not required to do from the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Interesting.
And
is that a fault of their system, though, that they can't really have a blank image? They can't modify the image, right? And then if they modify the image or take it down, do they have the capabilities to say, don't show this image and keep the comments
up? But it gets better.
Up.
There was a forum on Flickr talking about this issue.
They took that
and
down.
They took the forum down.
Okay, that's starting to become evil.
And so you have all those issues coupled with the fact that when there is a criticism of Obama, they've taken down. When there was an image that's a satire of Bush, they didn't.
Right. Is there a photograph currently on Flickr that was from a Time cover of Bush that's modified that's still up?
Right.
It would be a question.
So did anybody complain about it?
Yes.
Right. So there's that issue of how much of this is they had to do it legally and how much is a personal preference contrary to what the purpose of copyright.
Okay, so this is why everybody needs to go to journalism school in college. Like, everyone has to understand this concept.
Oh, excuse me, there's somebody on line one. They're asking that we stop talking about this subject.
Oh, okay, we're moving on. All right, what about you guys own an ISP.
No, not everyone needs to go to journalism school, just the people that work at Flickr.
Well, no, but that's the thing is that everybody's a publicist now, right? Everybody can publish things now. It's easy to publish. You spend, $20 a month and you have a website that can have anyone in the world see it, right? So therefore, everyone kind of has to understand the idea that you don't just take something down because you find it that you don't like it when you represent a large group of people.
I think one of the points is that Flickr, as the hosting service, I haven't read their end user licensing agreement, really, who has? But I know that all hosting services probably reserve the right to do as they see fit.
Right.
So they have done this in this case, and on its face, the actions look hypocritical. But let's not forget the fact that Flickr can basically do whatever they want within the bounds of the agreement they have with their users. And if somebody, we see this all the time. It's not just Flickr. We will run into this inevitably on our own forums where we have a policy or we have to develop a policy after, a string of abuses. That's how policies come about. And then we will one day enforce a policy and just trying to do the best that we can. And we know that some people will say, you're being hypocritical because why didn't you do it over here or whatever. So I just want to take a step back and say what happened at Flickr is probably that somebody tried to do the best job in response to a bunch of complaints. And then after the fact, it was, I was responding to a lot of complaints or something like that.
Right,
and,
right.
Oh, gee, in retrospect, so, I should have. We didn't get a lot of complaints about the Bush picture or whatever.
So I've done some forum management and had, you know.
It's a thankless job.
It's a thankless job. Speech that wasn't exactly polite, right? And you get to this point of going, do I stop this person from being able to communicate on this board, or do I try to train them to be more appropriate in this environment? And that decision is extremely hard to make. And I failed at it, and the forum kind of died because of it.
Right.
So that problem, I don't like to be in that position. I mean,
right.
I can understand
and
Flickr.
It's a great point.
Except
especially
so
if that was the reason given, saying we got a whole bunch of complaints about this and we want to have a community that can get along and we don't want to. But the argument they put forth was we got a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice
and we didn't
check up on it.
Well, I also, we get takedown notices every once in a while, and so far we haven't had to act on any of them because they don't follow the legally prescribed form for some reason that we went through. If you're a content host, you provide an abuse address, and then you have to get a complaint in a certain form. So if there is a takedown notice, the person whose content is taken down can ask that it be restored, and then you go through this little arbitration process back and forth to determine whether the copyright holder, you know, if there is a violation.
Who pays for the arbitration process? You?
Well, this is all laid out. You know, the DMCA is probably one of the best, you know, documented and scrutinized and commented upon forms of recent legislation. I just want to say that we run into this. And there is, it's not a great process, but there is recourse where the person should be able to go back to Flickr. But again,
I think assuming Flickr, they have the money for legal fees to file that.
You don't need legal fees go through the response to the takedown notice. And like I say, there is a prescribed process is encoded into the DMCA.
Also remember, Flickr is a free service. So this is a free thing that you've said, okay, I'm going to take advantage of this free service so that I can post my pictures up for free because they're giving it to me for free.
Right.
Okay. So I signed this agreement or agreed to an agreement to post up something, you know, where I don't have to pay. And so now
They have a lot of control over
it. If you're not paying for something, I guess the question
comes down to that kind of fundamental concept that if Flickr has a clear feeling about what is right and wrong in some way, and it sways how things work on their network, you really have to take that into account when you decide to put all your photos up there.
Yeah,
right.
The real issue is
everybody being clear on what the rules are.
In this
case, I think the bumbly story, you know, that puts out a line that isn't legally, factually true,
right,
confuses things and you know, can rile up the user.
And then there's also the fundamental mistake I think that people make, especially conspiracy theorists and that sort of thing, to think that an institution, just because it's big or just because it's visible, has some sort of a whole mind that it's making decisions,
right,
and that Flickr decided to go with to take down one and not to take down the other, when actually it was probably one or two people. And not even one or two the same people.
Right.
It's like, I'd better do this. Oh, I'd better do that. And then it appears inconsistent.
And I got a dentist appointment in an hour.
I'm supposed to do this.
You want to proceed with these stories with the presumption of best intention on all involved, because it's Occam's razor. I mean, only Cruzio is capable of pulling off a Star Chamber like conspiracy.
You
know? That's because we're a tight-grained group of professionals.
Let's move on. Al, what's going on with the iPhone apps?
Oh, here's a neat iPhone app. You basically can make a deposit of a check using a picture of a check. So, you know, I take out my phone, and this service exists. So I happen to be talking about an iPhone app, but you could do this with you know, any kind of
any phone
image
with a,
phone
okay.
thing. So, you know, you get your paycheck and you just take a picture of it and you can send it to this bank and, you know, it will deposit. This is a pretty interesting thing.
Do you then have to take the physical and deposit that as well, or are they cool with that being the only deposit?
No, that's it. That's the whole deal. The name of the bank is probably something people might like to know.
Sure. But you can find that on our website.
It's a USAA bank. And essentially, you just take a picture of the check and send it. I mean, really, checks, you know, the laws around checks really can be written on anything.
Right.
You know?
They're really clear that if you try to defraud, you're defrauding. So whether it's a paper check that you print out from your printer that's a fake one or a photograph that you've modified, either way, it's a criminal act.
So this is an app that's good for people who don't, like, just do payroll deposit?
Yeah. They don't want it. Or, you know, just... Or it's good for hackers, too, who are trying to hack somebody illegally.
And most of the crack
What if there's an SQL injection?
Well,
totally true. But that, of course, is true with any bank.
Yeah.
Because I get a lot of checks for the crack that I sell.
Because
that's the best
way to
do business.
How are you going to deposit those things?
Exactly.
I mean, really.
And I'm on the street. I want to get that in my bank right away.
You wonder about this stuff because, you know, but, you know, they're taking advantage of...
the crack or the checks?
Well, they're taking advantage of the cameras and the phones and trying to integrate it in a technology, you know.
Well, and the immediacy. You don't have to go visit an ATM machine, right? You're not using their power. Right. They don't have to destroy the piece of paper because, of course, they have to keep that piece of paper for a period of time until it clears, probably 30 days later. They store it somewhere. Then they pay a service to destroy it. It's ridiculous, really.
Right. And, you know, I look at this and I think, you know, this is really weird. But I've said the same thing about other stuff.
So
I wouldn't be surprised if 5 years from now we're taking pictures of our checks.
How about this? How about, you know, you and I want to do business and I want to send you a check, right?
Right.
So I just go on my computer. I, instead of say print, I just send it to a PDF. I email it to you. You send it to your bank.
Right.
Done. No paper ever.
Yep.
Love it.
Done.
But don't the banks hate that because they like to hold on to the money, right? They're always doing that stuff, like, 3-day hold
anyway.
And, oh, it's out of state, it's 5 days, no, it's too much money. You know, I would think they'd be, you know, pulling away from
that
sort of thing.
Maybe that's what they're looking for, is they want people to start sending them from their iPhones. And they're like, oh, it's a little blurry.
Yeah, right.
We started the transfer, but we're not going to finish it.
Well, this particular bank that's doing this, they only have one physical branch.
You want to have a virtual business.
Now all of a sudden, it's like...
And they're in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah. All your money's safe with us.
Yeah.
Thanks, Al, for that story. Miles, we got one more. I got time for one more.
Oh, this one, I'll try to keep it pretty short.
Go for it.
Wireless costs. And this refers to cell phone wireless costs. So if you were to take a medium usage plan, so this is the way that this report tallied it was 780 voice calls, 600 SMS messages, and 8 multimedia messages as a monthly plan.
Okay.
The prices across the world, or across the developed world, I should say, range from $11 per month to $53 per month for that service,
okay,
for that medium range.
Yeah,
we were?
Up in the 53.
Yeah, we were at that top range. The $11 range was the Netherlands, Finland, and Sweden, who are down at the low teens.
So they seriously only pay that much for their cell phone service?
Yes. Now, there's been some conjecture about why this is the case. Finland is a smaller area to have to deal with the rules, and they don't have to necessarily have a good roaming plan
for why is it so expensive?
Sweden and stuff like that. Well, because they're charging us an arm and a leg for text messages, for one. And
we've covered before that the text message actually is just part of the connection,
part of the carrier
cell phone
signal,
actually existing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No extra bandwidth is required for sending them. And MMS messages are ridiculously pricey in the U.S. compared
to the
rest of the
world. If you can even do one. I can't do one on my iPhone.
Right.
Okay, so that's depressing. Is it going to change?
Come the revolution.
We are taking calls starting now about ISPs. Okay, we're going to be talking about internet service providers. We do have the owners and operators of Cruise.io in-house right now, and we'll be chatting a little bit about the different stuff's going on. For example, they're buying the Sentinel building. Why the heck are they doing that? You'll find out in just a minute. You're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Miles Elam, Al Luckow, our guest Chris Nicholson, and Peggy Dulgis. Are you on to it?
Nice. No.
Dulgis.
Just helping.
All right.
Helping.
Thank you. That was good. We are talking about Cruise.io and of that sort. I want to mention, of course, that they're the founders of GeekSpeak, did it for 2 years before I came aboard with Mark as well, correct?
Mark Hanford, yeah.
Yeah, who's also still with Cruise.io, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Barbara Diamond kind of helped run things at some point, too.
She was our producer.
That's right.
Right. two couples get together, make Geek Speak start, and it's been a family organization ever since.
It is. It's been just fantastic. But I want to get back to the check thing. Can I take pictures of my money and give that to people when I buy things?
I think no.
Yes, you can.
I'm
legally no.
I'm going to start that.
Good
service.
Luck with that one.
I hope they sent you to a federal facility close to home, sweetie.
I'm just getting ready. I'm going to start taking pictures of my money.
Okay, so a couple weeks ago, I'm got pinged by like four people at once that said, Cruzat is buying the Sentinel building. And of course, everybody went, why are they buying a newspaper? There's a large building in Santa Cruz that's quite nice. That's been empty for quite a while since Sentinel moved over. Sentinel's the local paper, moved over the hill. You guys are buying this with a couple other businesses. What are you going to be doing in your space?
Oh, boy. We're going to move all of our people together.
We're currently on Pacific Avenue.
We have about a couple of facilities, and it'd be good to have everybody in one building. We have our servers in Santa Cruz and some are in Fremont. It'd be good to have them all in Santa Cruz. So we're going to be buying about a third of the building and then pulling some Boku fiber into it and putting a big dish and doing redundant backhaul wireless.
Good. So when somebody cuts a wire, you'll still have connection.
Not that that'll ever happen.
No, that's never happened before. So you also do a lot of classes. And as I was trying to figure out what you guys would do, I'd be like, they're going to do data center.
Oh, we're going to have
this
wonderful new training facility, projectors, wired up the wazoo.
Great. How many different rooms for that? Do you know? You started design stuff yet?
We're still beginning the design, but basically the premise for the whole thing is just that when we're in the economic doldrums, that's a good time to invest for the future, frankly. And we have, the way the internet is constructed, we're over we're over the mountains from a lot of the high speed pipes and stuff.
Right.
So we've had to keep some of our servers in Fremont just because it's faster. Like if you have a website on Cruzat, we put you right on the backbone. You have very, very fast in and out from your server all the time, and it's very redundant, very safe over there. And
that high-end data center with lots of bandwidth is a really
exactly.
important thing you're hosting.
And
sure.
we haven't been able to do that in Santa Cruz. We're local to Santa Cruz, and we put as much stuff here as we can. We like to invest in our community. We like to have the community involved in what we're doing, working for us, working with us. We're big supporters of KUSP, et cetera, et cetera. Some of our stuff has had to be it's still in the Bay Area, but it's over the hill. And we've just seen the opportunity when the prices are lower, there's more bandwidth available, there's more, construction's cheaper now. And we just saw the opportunity to bring it back. So it's our same operation, but just more of it is going to be in Santa Cruz.
Right.
So we're going to be able to use our dollars better locally and have the whole technology hub local. And with all that means in terms of, people from the area being able to use us enabling people to do a lot more and to get a lot faster transit in and out of Santa Cruz and a big hub where people can put their stuff, co-location and that sort of thing, to have a big center that's really, really well connected. And it's not a backwater because the connection, the internet connection, is fast enough that it's in the middle of things.
Right.
It might
so
as well be in Chicago.
How are you dealing with the fiber? I mean, can you talk about that yet? How
yeah,
are you
some,
fiber?
Some new fiber came over the hill that's not controlled by any carrier. Currently, people are probably actually really aware of this since the fiber cut that happened a couple of months ago. Fiber data and telecommunications traffic is all routed on AT&T fiber that goes south down past Watsonville and then over, to the data centers and whatnot, through the mountains down there. So some new fiber's been pulled that isn't owned by any carrier, and we're
this is part of the same branch that UCS is taking advantage of by getting
yeah,
dark fiber lines.
A cable, of several strands of fiber was brought over, so we're starting the process of getting a lease on some strands and getting our own gigabits over the hill. So the Sentinel is going to be one endpoint for that fiber in our new data center, and then we'll be connecting with Level 3 over in Sunnyvale.
That's wonderful. So are you going to also start providing, do you already sell T1s, right? Do you provide larger than that in Santa Cruz?
No.
No. So are you going to be able to do that with this, or do you? Is that
yes.
become a different? You become
yes.
a different business kind of.
We're going to be in a very interesting business. We'll be able to provide. We'll have our data center for colocation services for people to put their servers with us,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll also start branching the fiber out to larger customers that need gigabit level Ethernet. On top of that, we're going to be offering. Very high-speed wireless services for folks and businesses.
Because, we could see, we've got, I guess the email boxes show we've got about 20,000 people using our service, and we can see this huge curve, upward curve of people using bandwidth,
Yay, and Hulu and YouTube, right?
Exactly, And
GeekSpeak, which streams over the KUSP servers provided by
Kuzio. We chew up so much bandwidth every 1 hour.
Spit it out.
Mostly it's Lyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mostly
his talking.
80% of the
faster.
Show is me talking.
Yeah.
A lot more data goes through.
I have a question. There's a lot of these new great services coming in, and this is going to be fantastic for the community and all that kind of stuff. The thing that kind of strikes me, though, is you guys were here during the dot-com boom, like the beginning. I remember being in Santa Cruz and Cruzeo coming out, and people, they're listening to the radio and they're saying, oh, it's an ISP or something. But this is like an ISP that was here, like when things were just starting.
We were one of the first ISPs.
I'd kind of like to know just
in America.
I'd like to know something about
maybe the world.
But,
really,
what did you do? Were you just sitting around and you're like, hey, we could maybe do something with this whole internet thing that's people are starting to buy computers and there's this Mosaic browser. I mean,
how'd you do it?
Can
it
you just
goes
well,
back
what was that?
Further than that? Back in the early 80s, there was the BBS scene. Personal computers mm-hmm. were just available and you could hook up to BBSs.
That means you take your phone, you dial a specific phone number, right. Another modem answers, and you're able to communicate. After you hang up, somebody else does the same
BBS
thing.
BBS is a lot like a forum, a glorified forum.
Bulletin
and
board
this
system.
Was really before this was way before the internet as it was. There was still the high-speed scientific network that was the precursor to the internet. And then slowly but surely, the BBSs started networking, and they had these goofy little networking protocols that they used just to pass messages back mm-hmm. and forth. About that time, Peggy and I were working for a local software company, SCO, before they went bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both political. Back then, there was a lot of craziness involving Central America and nuclear weapons and whatnot. And we started using email at work, and we saw this is an incredible organization coordination tool, and we want to help bring email to the masses. And so we had a couple of incarnations of Cruzio on various servers using various pieces of software
mm-hmm.
That were designed, sort of vertical market software designed for forum type of activities.
So providing people with email.
Well, or about 1989, that's when we started our current incarnation of Cruzio, and we had a Unix server that, I used what was open source at the time to put together email, BNews, Usenet stuff, and then we had this really cool, exotic $2,000 Trailblazer Telebit 9600 modem with a proprietary protocol, and we called Arlington, Virginia every day, about 3 or 4 times a day, long distance,
uh-huh.
to connect to UUNet.
UUNet. Mm-hmm.
Early UUNet back uh-huh. then on the UUCP network just to pass email.
Yeah.
And the newsgroup messages back.
UUCP, Unix to Unix copy.
That's right.
For
all you youngins out there.
I was going to say that you were talking about 12 years. Cruzio's 20 years
20
old.
20 years, yeah.
And it would be hard to find another ISP that's 20 years old. That's,
that was my point, was it's not just a another ISP that popping up. This is like a local thing that's been here. And you guys were here, doing the
years,
BBS
right?
thing and just... just, you know, you put yourselves together. This
we go back to flint tools.
That's right, before the Iron Age.
The server ran on gas.
That's right.
20 years ago, setting up sendmail servers that you have to maintain the scripts on. And
yeah.
You had to read that sendmail book.
No, building a lot of it by hand, you know, just the things that we used to put together because it wasn't commercially available. So we just strung things together, I mean, in terms of everything, bookkeeping, customer service, all that kind of stuff.
So you guys are kind of geeks then, in some sense.
So here's
we're the original. You're forgetting. We are the original geeks.
So here's the question. So you got
open source
software. Yeah. So you got open source software and got things up and running. Did you ever submit patches back?
No, because what we ended up doing, for those of you who don't know, the internet is primarily run on open source software. For instance, most of the web servers are out there use Apache, which is a completely free and open source product.
Which means that all the details of how it gets created is open to everybody, and everybody volunteers to create it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. What we end up doing, the kind of code that we write and have always written tends to be what I call glue or integration code. So back in the early day, for instance, I would download, Elm or something like that from the UCP.
Elm being an email client.
Right. Text-based.
From the UUNET FTP archives. Mm-hmm. You know, this was open source at the time. And then CNews, the UUNET stuff. And then I wrote the menu system that just used it. So that's always, we don't patch the code. Because the code is so robust and it's way beyond our level of expertise and whatnot. What we end up doing is just writing.
Make it more friendly to a user to use it.
Or
accessible.
Or internally. Yeah. I mean, we run all of our internal systems are all based on SQL, non-injectable, web-based applications and things like that. So,
all right, let's... I want to chat about classes because lots of times we get calls and it's clear that people just want more information about computers. We normally send people off to their local community college, which have some awesome
fantastic
things. Cabrillo has
resource.
Some great.
Cabrillo really made a huge investment in their computer department. They're a valuable resource. Yeah.
And I could have sworn I've seen Cruzeiro alumni teaching at Cabrillo.
Yes, and you know, current Cruzeiro employees sometimes are teaching there, and then we do have some former employees who are still teaching there who started. When they were with us, yeah. So we donate to them. We donate some web space, I think, still and to them as well as other local.
And you guys also run your own school classes.
We have classes.
Mm-hmm. What kind of topics?
Web publishing, for instance, has gone from the model of you rent a room and then you get to wallpaper it yourself to using content management systems like Joomla, WordPress, or Drupal. So we offer classes in content management systems. We offer classes for people who are hosting websites to do search engine optimization, mm-hmm. tricks to get more traffic. So things like that. Most of our classes now are really geared towards web hosting, you know, site hosting. Mm-hmm. And
is that what people, I mean, people are going to, you know, what do you find people are wanting to know nowadays? You know,
people are moving, publishers, you know, those of us who just consume information, we consume web pages and we send in and receive email. And a lot of that is now known. There's not a lot to offer in a class.
Most people know how to do that, right?
How to use a web browser.
Although we do offer Internet 101 for people who have trouble with computers. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are always swearing at their computers or whatever, blaming their computers.
I mean, I'm just curious
if you have any sort of a business, and Santa Cruz has so many small businesses and even larger businesses, you want a website. If you're a lawyer or a doctor, if you have a single person office, no matter what you do, you want a website.
Yeah, if you're not online,
room,
it doesn't exist.
We all know this. Yeah. And mm-hmm. the business community is certainly, you know, very cognizant of this as well. And so that's what people are really into.
So people listening to the show right now who are sitting around, well, I'm not a web developer. What do I think about? Why would I want to take classes? But really, people are taking classes, whether they're web developers or just normal people or people that just want to be more involved in their business?
We kind of have sort of two levels. What we offer, you know, we've got Joomla. The content management systems make it a lot easier for people to build a site and then maintain it, and for maybe those not to be the same people.
So the CMS system, which Lyle, you can...
Content management system.
Because people are wondering, what the heck are they...
Yeah, content management system. I do a lot of Drupal development on campus, and the part of the GeekSpeak website is me and Miles edited one together. We also use WordPress. No, we use Drupal up there. We use WordPress as well. I have a Noah site that uses Joomla. I don't like it very much. But basically, all these applications are a complex web application, which makes adding pages and editing stuff really easy. You can kind of think of it as a blog tool on steroids. So you can have an event system in there. You can have a forum system plugged in by just a few clicks.
It's modular, really, you know. You put it together. It's like one of those prefab houses or something.
Yeah. You kind of pick the things you want and put it together, and there's the website.
So you could, you know, you can either say, hey, I'm pretty handy, I'm going to do it. And you pick up the pieces and put them together. And our classes teach you how to do that. We also work a lot with consultants and web designers, and their field changes so fast that, you know, like a few years ago it was Dreamweaver, and everybody was doing Dreamweaver, which is basically designing it like it's all
static document,
linear, but you could do a lot with it, and it was complicated, so it took a lot of time to learn. And then, boom, 2 years later, okay, forget it. Throw away Dreamweaver. That's a $900 program. You put it in the garbage. Now you got the next thing, you know?
Miles, we are totally way ahead of the curve.
What is the next thing, though, by the way? Because I happen to be using Dreamweaver, so...
It's still viable and everything, but you're looking at the next stuff coming up, which is around right now, which is the CMS. And So Chris, I was always trying to stay there, you know, even faster than the colleges can be, really, to just stay a little bit ahead of the curve, saying, okay, if you're a consultant or a web designer or something, we've got the next bunch of tools. You can start learning about the next bunch of tools.
You can be a little more responsive to the public as well, because whereas a school has to, you know, they find the catalog and say, okay, we've got to find the teacher. By the time the schools have these courses and all that kind of stuff, it's already kind of, they're just hanging on, whereas you can say, hey, let's offer a course in Flex.
Right.
People are using Flex right now.
We're already doing it ourselves. That's the thing. A lot of times the stuff that we have, the networks that we have, the servers and computers and stuff, and the website that we have, you know, we're working on it. So the minute we're doing it, we're saying, okay, let's start helping the consultants in our area, the web designers in our area, learn about this stuff too.
Let me go ahead and ask what you want to learn about internet technologies. Like, what kind of class would you like to see? You can call us right now and answer that question. Phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. That's in the 831 area code. Or you can call us toll-free anywhere in the continent, I think. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Again, let me be clear. We're going to stay on topic today. We're going to talk about ISPs. Maybe you can ask some questions about DSL. Sure, what the heck. And also about web development, maybe classes you might be interested, or how to maybe teach a friend that's having a lot of trouble with understanding something, maybe a parent or something. The phone numbers, again, are 476-2800, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. That's 1-800-655-KUSP. And just to let you know, currently in the air room with me, we have Miles Elam and Al Lockow. They're regular geeks. And GeekSpeak founders Chris Nicholson and Peggy Dulges is here. They also run Cruzeo, one of the oldest existing ISPs in the country, the world.
You know, I have a question. This is a question I like to ask people like you guys, Chris and Peggy.
There's no one like us.
Nobody's like you, but
thank you.
Somebody who might be of your ilk. All right. What service, when you go home and you're in your house and you open up your laptop, what are you using to connect to the internet?
Firefox.
You okay. mean browser. Like in terms of...
I'd like to know what you're connecting to the internet for. Are you using DSL or Comcast?
We use DSL at home.
You don't use Comcast cable?
No.
Our rival.
But I'm looking forward to our 100 megabit wireless connection. Drool, drool.
So that'll be faster?
That's one reason we started an ISP was that we wanted the fastest possible internet connection.
Isn't that why you're gonna put yourself out on the line there and do your pilot project for the high-speed wireless just to make sure that all the bugs are out, right? Just
yeah, exactly. And
yeah,
I'm
you're
serious.
Reading our minds,
we're,
really.
We're going to get a dish on our roof.
Our first customer.
And I cannot wait.
Always us. Yeah.
That's what the motivation is for most geeks. I mean, you hear about Steve Wozniak. He was building a computer for himself.
Right.
He wanted something to do. Sure. Himself. And you guys just said we need this fast network, and you're just doing things for yourself, and it's just benefiting everybody.
And
we're
thinking
like
about
the hair club. We are our own best customers.
But no, I mean, when we were starting out, and still, you know, we're kind of wide-eyed idealists and everything, and we're always believing that communication is a good thing. You know, pictures of the president with Hitler mustaches notwithstanding. You know, sometimes it's hard to remember it, but really, we always believed that the more people could communicate, the more that they would produce their own, you know, publish their own thoughts and ideas and artwork and everything else, the better it is, you know. So we're still looking at that and enabling people to go even further and do even
wait,
more.
Wait, with that kind of feeling, how are you guys survived as a business for 20 years?
Through the kindness and generosity of our fine community, I suppose. We've got a very creative community. I think they think that way, too. You know, like we're out there saying, hey, you know, if you're an artist, you can put your pictures online. And they're right there.
Also, the bottom line is customer service. I mean, we chose to be a for-profit enterprise back in the day. I mean, community networking community was going, you know, we were one of the few who said, we're going to go with capitalism. You guys can go after grants if you want. We really appreciate the feedback, which is people, you know, re-upping every month. And we have a very vocal customer base that lets us know when, you know, what they want and what we could do better, what we're doing well and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and take a call from Watsonville. Fred, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I really appreciate Cruise.io's community service of the service to the artists. My wife is an Open Studios artist, and we're in this funny situation. Hope this is not too geeky, but we need internet access just for the 2 weekends of Open Studios in our new studio. And it seems like tethering through a cellular wireless signal might be an answer, but I can't quite figure out how to do it at a reasonable cost.
For a short term.
My cellular service doesn't offer it. I don't know if there, I mean, it, you know, it's either I've got to lay in a phone line, set up an internet access, and
I run into this exact problem. We, in the UCSD program that I help manage, Digital Arts New Media program, I have students that need to go on the street and do things. And so I had to enter into a one-year contract with Sprint to have a one of these tethering devices. And that's the minimum that you can do it with them is a year. So I guess the best thing would be to try to find someone that could loan it to you for the weekend. I think that would be a good thing. I can't loan it to you because it's UCSD property, unfortunately. But I'm assuming there's people out there that use it for travel, and sometimes they don't, and maybe they like to be around for Open Studios and don't need it. That's kind of the best bet, I think. You guys have any suggestions on?
Yeah, Fred, are you close geographically to anybody who has existing internet service, like a buddy next door or something? Because
I've been knocking on all the doors and asking, and so far I've gotten it's our corporate branded internet service, and we can't share it.
Did you bring pie with you, like apple pie, when you did this?
I offered to put in a wireless router and set up and leave it there with them if they want.
That's as good as pie.
You know what, Fred? I think the sad fact of the matter is that you are surrounded by the undeserving, and that you're an island of light in a sea of darkness.
That doesn't get him anywhere, though.
I know.
All right, so here, we'll help you out a bit.
Does anybody besides Sprint support tethering?
Yes.
Verizon.
I think we'll have to take this offline, Fred, but what I want to suggest is if you want to support an Open Studio artist in October, getting some wireless so that they can be part of Open Studios more effectively, and you have a tethering thing you don't use all the time, why don't you give us an email, and we'll hook you up with Fred in Watsonville to do that.
Great. I'll post it in the forum. Thanks for the help.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Thanks, Fred.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, hopefully there's someone out there with a MiFi device that they could
yeah,
show up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could actually hack your iPhone and do that with that, but through Bluetooth. But that does take a hack to do that.
Yeah. It's yeah, that's also against
that would be
service.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's right.
We would never suggest anyone do anything of that sort.
You should not repeat, not jailbreak your iPhone.
Wait, not repeat, not wait. Oh, two negatives.
Actually, if Fred is near one of our hotspots, I'm
that
sure
might work.
We
could boost the signal.
Yeah, well, or just hop him over somehow.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The Geeks Today, Al Luckow, Miles Elam. The guests today, Chris Nicholson and Peggy Dolges, and they are the co-founders of Cruise.io. They're still running Cruise.io 20 years now. They're the founders of GeekSpeak as well, 12 years, 11 years in the making, something like that. And Chris and Peggy, thank you so much for being here with
us. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And, of course, we have a great connection with you, and any questions that people have about Cruise.io and such, let me know, and we'll get them through you. Of course, you also have great tech support, so you can call them directly. And you can learn more about Cruise.io by going to cruise.io.com. Right?
Yes. Please do.
And let's Al is gracious enough to give our USB of the week.
Al here, and it's time for GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. You may be a mild-mannered programmer doing JSP, AJAX, or jQuery. Sure, you wear khakis and a polo shirt, but, well, maybe not exactly Polo the brand, but a polo-like shirt with a Java 1 logo on it. Still, on the outside, people see one thing, but it's the inside where the mystery lies. Enter the Solid Alliance Ninja USB Shuriken Flash Drive. Shurikens, for those who don't know, are star-shaped metal discs that are thrown by ninjas. It only holds 2 gigabytes, but hey, it's a shuriken. It comes in a wooden box, just like ninjas have things in wooden boxes. The box is lined with something that almost feels like black velvet. Show your inner ninja with the Ninja USB Shuriken Flash Drive.
For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Choxel. Stay tuned now for Car Talk. We'll be here online every week, geekspeak.org, KUSP.org.